I was asked to put this together rather at the last minute, and I'm afraid it, shows. We have actually more data than I'm going to show you today, mainly because I haven't had time to think about it, and even worse, I couldn't find some of the data I wanted on the computer. So at any rate, I'll show you what we have. All right. So this, I'm going to tell you about some work that we've done on shear thickening and worm-like micelles. We started work on this stuff when I was still back at Exxon, which was a long time ago. I've been here since 95. And it started when somebody walked into my lab with this stuff that looked like water. I remember he just took it like this and he turned it like this back and forth, looked like water. And then he shook it up and the stuff looked like goo. You know, it was incredibly viscous. And I said, why does it do that? So some 8 years later, I still don't know why it doesn't, but, but here we are. Actually, I have Jacqueline's name on there, but I'm not going to tell you about any of our work because you guys have heard much more about the theory than I could intelligently present. But the experiments have been done by Chuhang Liu, Philip Boltenhagen, Yan Tao Hu, and since this is an old slide, I forgot to add also my graduate student, Jennifer Polich. Some of the stuff at the end is her stuff, too. All right, so this is just a quick reminder. We're working with worm-like micelles. We're working in the neighborhood of the CMC. All right, some of our data are a little below, or not the CMC. We're always above the CMC. We're working in the neighborhood of the overlap concentration. All right, some of our data are a little bit above the overlap concentration. Some of them are a little bit below the overlap concentration. For us, overlap is crudely defined as when the viscosity is twice that of water. Or actually, another way of defining it is when the system shows appreciable shear thinning. And there's sort of a one thing that we've looked at recently that I'll talk about a little bit at the end is the onset of shear thinning prior to the shear thickening in these solutions, which I'm beginning to think is important. I'll show you data on a number of different systems. They all look sort of like this. This sort of classic one of CTAB, sodium salicylate, and water that form worm-like micelles. These salicylate ions, or something like them, seem to be present in virtually all these shear thickening systems. In this system, they insert themselves into the micelle. And they are negatively charged, whereas the CTAB ion is positively charged. So it yields a worm-like micelle that at least at one-to-one molar ratios gives you something that's roughly neutral, all right? But with a lot of counter ions in solution and clearly probably depending fairly critically on some of these electrostatic interactions. All right, so here's sort of some classical data that we've observed and other people have observed. You take some of this stuff and you put it in a shear cell, say a couette cell, and at time and it's well rested, and at time t equals zero, you turn on the machine, say at a constant shear rate in this case, and then you measure the viscosity. All right, and what you get for the viscosity is a curve that looks like this. That is, it rises up to some plateau, and it usually takes its time about doing so. Here in this case, it took on the order of 3 minutes, and that's sort of typical. It can be shorter or longer depending upon the concentration. In this case, the viscosity is increased by, I don't know, about a factor of 3. All right, that can vary quite a bit too. You can get increases on the order of 50 or so in some cases. Also, when you're in the steady state, this data is typically noisy. all right? That is, this is not instrumental noise. That's noise that somehow is characteristic of the system itself. You can then plot up this plateau viscosity as a function of shear rate, and you generally get a curve something like this. I mean, these are actually data corresponding to this system, where you see that below some shear rate, actually the system behaves in what most of us would consider a normal way. In this case, it's shear thinning because it's a little bit above the overlap concentration. If it were below the overlap concentration, this would be flat, all right, and you'd see that. Then there's an abrupt jump, and the system typically looks something like this. That is, there might be a flat region followed by a region where it seems to shear thin again.
Yeah, can I just ask a comment about your comment of shear thinning prior to overlap? I mean, ordinary pore polymer melts very short and low molecular weight below ME do still unfortunately shear thin.
Sure, sure. And so
the RAS model doesn't try to capture something like that.
So, I mean, and perhaps you'd expect these to shear thin, too. That is, if you just have long, unentangled micelles, perhaps they do shear thin. I don't think that we have microscopic information about what's going on.
Well,
so,
shouldn't shear thin at 20 radians per second?
I'm sorry?
They shouldn't shear thin at these kind of shear rates unless they're either entangled or unusually big.
Yeah, and I think what we're going to see is that these things are unusually big. These things, I mean, I think maybe there's some evidence that these things, under certain circumstances, have no end caps. All right, that is that they're essentially a gel. Okay, so let me tell you about our experimental approach. What we wanted to do, actually. It's always funny about how you present something because it sounds like you set out to do this on purpose, but of course we didn't. We set out to do something different and then noticed that we could do this sort of by accident and sort of took advantage of an accident, really. But what we ultimately did was this, is we set up our system in a couette cell and we make it transparent, we make it out of glass, and then we illuminate the shear cell with a sheet of laser light. So we take the light, focus it with this, and then use a cylindrical lens to expand it into a sheet that we illuminate the gap with. All right. Then we look at the scattered light from that laser sheet and image it with a video camera, all right, and so and here's the sort of images we get. Actually, you can see that there's a little white area here, and then it's darker over here. While that's perhaps seems a little bit subtle and may look like I'm interpreting a bit, when you see the videos and you watch it in real time, you're quite convinced that this is one thing, and that this over here is something else, all right. And there's nothing particularly subtle about it. It's very obvious.
What is contrast here? It's the
contrast is
the
scattering.
Birefringence
it's not birefringence. We're just looking at the scattering here. All right. These systems are birefringent, but we're not looking at the birefringence.
Yeah, but the laser is polarized, right?
The laser is polarized.
So you may get some contrast from
Well, yeah, that's true to a certain extent. The laser comes in polarized like this. Wait.
You did take both components. We don't have an analyzer. Don't use an analyzer.
We don't use any analyzer.
Yeah, but without analyzer, you get a little bit of contrast.
So the contrast is due to stronger scattering from this region than that region.
Is experiment made with contrastless, where you see the two regions?
I'll come to that. All right, I'll come to that. Okay, so this first experiment I want to tell you about is an experiment done under controlled shear rate. All right. So, and this is this curve I showed you back at the beginning. So the experiment is we've let a well rested sample come to equilibrium, and then we apply a constant shear rate. In this case, the shear rate. Somehow the ampersand is shouldn't be there. It's 80 inverse seconds. All right. I think that was supposed to be a dot. And down here, what you see. So what you see up here is you see a completely dark sample. This real bright spot here is just some scattering from the inner cylinder. But this is the inner cylinder. That's the outer cylinder. If you want the details, in this case, the inner cylinder is moving, all right, but not fast enough to cause any problems with turbulence or instabilities. All right. At this time here, where the viscosity has risen only a little bit, you see that you get this white area emerging from the inner cylinder. All right. And then as you wait in time, you see that, and you see that as the viscosity goes up, this white area moves across the sample. So it seems clear that the white stuff is at the very least more viscous than the dark stuff. And interestingly, you get to here, it's almost all the way across, not quite. And then ultimately it goes all the way across, and you end up with something that seems to span the sample. There's a fair bit of structure inside of there, and it's dynamic. There's stuff moving around clearly when you have these images. One of the first things you want to ask then is, what's the velocity profile inside the sample? All right, so we did something fairly crude. Namely, we took our cylindrical lens, rotated it by 90 degrees so that now we slice the sample or the sample cell in the horizontal plane, and then we could view that from the bottom. The system was effectively seeded. We didn't actually have to seed it in general. There are enough little specks of dirt that we could actually follow them in the flow. You can purposely do it too, although seeding it with things like polystyrene spheres and so forth can have a tendency to shift. It doesn't change the qualitative behavior, but it can change the quantitative behavior in terms of moving the critical shear rate around. So then we just watched and saw how far these spots moved between video frames, and in that way mapped out the velocity profile. And what we had here is, initially, after 6 seconds in this particular experiment, we had a nice linear velocity profile across the sample. Then after the system had started to shear thicken, when you had this gel across here, what you see is that the inner all this stuff is just moving with the inner cylinder like a solid block. And then across this area, you get a more or less constant shear rate. All right, so clearly it makes sense to call this something like a gel. You can argue as to whether it's really a gel or not, but just an operational definition, we'll call it a gel here. Eventually, this moves all the way across, and then there's a slip, and it's like there's a slip layer here. All right, this is pretty generic. All right, sometimes, not every time, but sometimes you'll see it actually slip at the inner cylinder too after a while. All right. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. But what it looks like is, it looks like you have sort of a solid sheared plug, all right, with a slip at one or both of the surfaces.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
The asymmetry in the system important? Does the gel always form?
It always starts on the inner cylinder. It always starts on the inner cylinder. Well, I say that, and then I'm going to show you an exception to it, though.
Okay.
All right. Most of the time. I'll tell you more about that in a second. Let's see. Oh, geez, this is really good. That's funny.
I will understand now.
Yes, yes. This is what you get for changing from one computer to another. How about that? Pardon?
No,
no, no, it's from a PC to a PC, but obviously they have different fonts.
So you have to find CDX in Microsoft.
All right.
Sure. Sometimes the feature only comes up on the overhead projector when it's fine on the screen.
Yeah. I mean, you can sort of understand this curve in sort of a simple sense. That is, if you're doing this under controlled shear rate, and you let some gel starts to grow on the inner cylinder, that means that the shear rate in the remaining part of the sample is bigger than the actual applied shear rate. In fact, it's bigger than the shear rate that nucleated the stuff at the surface. All right. So clearly, you have a problem. That is, if that much shear rate was enough to generate a viscous gel-like structure, then you might expect that to happen in the rest, and it sort of run away with you and propagate all the way across the cell. And I think that that's more or less consistent with the data. Indeed, in this little model that Jacqueline and I adapted from Armand Ajdari, you can actually generate curves based on just that sort of simple, the sort of simplest kind of model you can imagine that follow this curve extremely well. I elected not to include that, but it just sort of says that that kind of picture makes sense. It doesn't tell you anything about microscopically what's going on, but it is a sort of a sensible way to go.
On its way, you might actually rather generically expect the increased shear rate to force nucleation on the other cylinder and it to work backwards and get in the middle once the shear rate has gone up a large amount in the gap. Does that seem to happen?
That doesn't seem to happen. But let me come back. It's actually probably useful here for me just to sort of tell you the story of the next few slides, because it'll elucidate a lot of these issues.
I may be anticipating what you're going to tell us, but just referring back to the work of you and Jack, I mean, in that model, it's the stress that's responsible.
Right,
for
it's the stress.
But you're talking about a critical shear rate for this to occur.
Right.
That's why I'm a little confused.
So I think it is the stress, and what I'm trying to do is sort of take you through the data and let the data sort of speak for itself, and but I think it is in fact the stress. And here's what begins to make you think that that might be true. So in this experiment, we do the same experiment we just did before, except this time we apply a constant stress. All right, and what you see is you see the same sort of generic curve. That is, the system starts to increase and increases slowly over time to some plateau. Interestingly, the noise is somewhat slower here. It's a lot slower, as a matter of fact. So this was for a stress of 0.6 pascals. So here you can see at this point it's grown out to here. All right. Then it grows a little bit further, and it stops. It actually stops here and just stays like this more or less forever. All right. And you can actually, if you're real careful and watch the video camera and watch your rheometer at the same time, you can actually see that there's a direct correlation between the height of this apparent viscosity and the height of the gel. All right. So, but here, when you're applying a constant stress, you have a sort of negative feedback mechanism. That is, if you start to make more gel and the system becomes effectively more viscous, at a constant stress, that means the shear rate will slow down a little bit. All right, and that was the reason we tried it, just to ask ourselves, is that indeed what happens? And that does seem to be what happens.
Excuse me. In this case, do you use the same
rheometer?
So, in fact, it's...
Nope, we used a different rheometer.
Yeah, but the stress is controlled by the computer, by the software, or is it controlled by the hardware?
It's controlled by the hardware. This is a rheometer that wants to produce controlled stress. It can try and produce controlled shear rate, but there it uses a feedback.
That,
Have you done a power spectrum or time series analysis to see if there's a characteristic time scale for these interfaces fluctuating back and forth?
No.
Because related to your physical picture, what you're saying is that if in the non-gel side the deformation rate is above some certain level, it erodes the gel and the gel retracts back, and then if that deformation rate's lower, then there's a growth process where it's creeping and it's going back.
Where it's higher, when it's
So wait, high rate erodes it and makes it go back? Or wait, did I get that exactly?
You got it exactly backwards. You're applying a constant stress, and if it gets too big, then it slows down and it retracts.
Okay, right. So near the peak, the gel is thicker.
Right.
The overall viscosity is higher, the deformation rate is lower, and it erodes.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you analyze this power spectrum, it should give you information about the erosion.
About
rate,
the dynamics.
The deposition
about
rate
the
as a
about the dynamics of this. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay, so then you increase the stress and see what happens. So this one's at 1.2 pascals. Hello. All right, and it sort of does the same thing. It goes up faster this time. This time it creeps all the way across the cell. All right, and it progresses faster. But other than that, it looks more or less the same. And as it says in red there, there seems to be a close correspondence between the apparent viscosity and the thickness of the gel. So your feeling is, okay, I understand how this works. But
it's pretty low stress.
It's a pretty low stress.
Yes.
It is a very low stress.
You didn't call it a gel, but it's not like most gels you pick up.
No. You'd have a hard time picking up this gel. These are the world's softest gels, except for the gels that I think exist in equilibrium, which are even softer. All right.
Okay, I'm sorry, I'm confused.
He's just saying that this modulus is really low.
How can you compare? How can you say anything about the elasticity of the gel when in fact you do have a lot of you have a blood flow? Which means the stress here is really the stress you need to shear a thin layer on each side. It doesn't tell you about the elasticity of
it. The stress is the same in the gel.
Yes, but
you don't know about the deformation.
But actually, you don't know much about. You don't.
The gel may the G prime of the gel may be higher than that. I don't know.
Right. Let's come back to that because the one way you can address that is by shearing it hard enough that the gel fractures.
Okay.
All right.
This is how you read.
All right.
Yeah.
And what we'll find is that the gel fractures at stresses not too far above this.
Okay.
All right. But that's a point well taken. Yeah, it's probably. All right. So, but just when you think you understand it, this correspondence between the gel thickness and the apparent viscosity, you see that it doesn't always work. Here's one at 1.6 pascals. All right. And here, first, you see nothing happening. And then here, it's a little bit hard to tell from this picture, but you certainly see it clearly from the video. All right, there's really gel appearing throughout this thing, all the way through. Gel in the sense that you see increased scattering. All right, then you go a little bit further, and it just gets brighter. All right, it gets really bright. All right, and look at how much the apparent viscosity has gone up. Almost nothing. All right.
I have a problem with your pictures that you are showing us. Actually, when we expect something which goes with the velocity, and you are showing us some strange figures, you know, which are not parallel to the velocity, what are the things we are seeing on these pictures?
You're seeing.
Is the flow really laminar or
In this one, I claim the velocity gradient across the cell is perfectly. It's just what you expect. It's a constant shear rate across the cell. All right.
Oh, but the geometry versus the gradient direction, where the vorticity direction, the flow direction.
It's in other words, does the gel go all the way across there? This is the gradient plane. Yeah.
And we are looking the upward inflow direction. Yeah.
Right. So here's the inner cylinder. Here's the outer cylinder. And the inner cylinder is going around like this. All right. So that's the geometry. That's the geometry.
And so a follow-on question, if you put your sheet of light so that you're able to track particles, you don't see them going in and out of focus. They stay in the plane if they were in focus.
So far as I know, here, yeah, certainly at this shear rate, yes. All right. At this shear rate, at this stress, yes. All right. And then you keep going further. What's interesting here is at 50 seconds where the viscosity is bigger, it looks like, if anything, the scattering is weaker. All right, and then finally you get to this steady state, and everything's happy. All right, so what's happening here? All right, what's happening, I believe, is you're getting essentially nucleation of the new phase throughout the gap simultaneously. So what this white is it's little regions of the new phase, little droplets of the new phase nucleating, but they haven't percolated, all right? So you just have a slight increase in viscosity as though you have sort of a colloidal colloidal suspension. When you get up here where the scattering is maximum, all right, it's because you have the maximum fluctuations, all right, in the density. It's not because you have a gel, it's because you have the maximum fluctuation. So you have, the picture is here, is that you have little balls, all right, of gel phase, all right, that scatter. Once they start hooking up, that is, and the viscosity starts getting bigger, all right, or once they start hooking up, the viscosity gets bigger, all right. When that happens, the scattering goes down because the system is, in fact, more homogeneous than it was before, all right. Then you reach this state where there's increased scattering, but not by a whole lot, when you have essentially a homogeneous gel across the sample, and again with slip at the edges.
So Dave, you are telling us that it's exactly the same story than the previous one, it's just the nucleation of the gel, which is following a different way.
Right.
Instead of being starting from the surface, it just starts in the bulk.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay,
and so that's why I wanted to wait to answer your question.
Obviously, the velocity profile along this curve is different from the one you
right.
have shown us.
Right.
In fact, you might not say it's nucleation, but it just becomes unstable above some stress.
Well, it becomes unstable. I don't know if you want to call it nucleation. Maybe you want to say it's maybe you want to say it's spinodal. Maybe you want to say it's spinodal decomposition. But either one, I view
nucleation.
No.
Okay.
Do you have a hypothesis for why the surface plays a role? It lowers stress, you believe that it consistently propagates, and it also knows the difference between the two surfaces.
Right.
So
well, I think that
the fluid know?
Basically because the stress is higher at the inner cylinder.
Yeah, but if you make the gap thinner and thinner, eventually that effect should be gone, right? These fairly thick gaps.
These gaps are, and these experiments, I believe, were 1 or 2 millimeters. I actually no longer remember. It's been so long. Was this 1 millimeter? This is 1 millimeter gap.
Oh, how much higher is the stress at the inner cylinder than the outer?
Remember that the stress goes as the radius squared. It goes as the radius squared. And so these are 1 millimeter gaps with, 1.5 centimeter radius, something like that.
Can I just try something else on you?
Sure.
I mean, let's go back to this. Could be the shear rate. I mean, at higher stress, you actually have a higher shear rate, and it's a uniform shear rate.
Right.
And you get nucleation right across the gap.
Right.
So why is it the stress and not the shear rate?
Good question. I'll leave it at... So I say homogeneous nucleation. Okay, and so here's just sort of anticipating the obvious question about how the stress goes as 1 over the radius squared, all right? And so the stress is gradius near the inner cylinder. When the stress or shear rate is increased incrementally, the gel nucleates only at the inner cylinder. and when it's increased sufficiently high so that the the stress is greater than the critical stress, it nucleates everywhere. There's actually one thing that you might there's one thing that you might want to say that we really can't tell. You could imagine that in the other cases where it appears to be growing out from the edge, that in some sense that might be apparent. That is, that the nucleation, pardon the word, I just need some word, of the new phase occurs throughout the sample, but that there's time for that new phase to to move towards the inner cylinder, which it might do if you imagine that you have a highly elastic material, you have it stretched along the streamlines, and so you get develop some hoop stresses that would tend to move that stuff in towards the inner cylinder. So I'd be hard pressed to say that that can't be happening. All right. So just in the interest of full disclosure, that probably should be said. All right. So now if you put all this together, you get diagrams that look like this, stress versus shear rate. This is the region below this is just a single phase region. If you control the shear rate, you follow these blue squares where you go from this point and then you increase the shear rate and it goes up to here and follows this curve. If you do constant stress, you follow these red ones, all right, and you can get this region here where you have these gels that partially fill the gap. That's what's happening in here. All right.
The homogeneous nucleation phase is which one?
The homogeneous nucleation is we get homogeneous nucleation when we put the stress up at about here, right about there. And then you get the homogeneous nucleation.
That's stress, by the way.
Yes?
Okay.
This is stress. This is stress versus shear rate, all right, the way you like it plotted.
Yeah, no, I know that.
So just to irritate,
I appreciate very much.
Just to irritate you, I did it a different way.
I was just
so let me do.
Can you tell, it doesn't matter, stupid question, but is that the stress at the inner or the outer circle?
It's some average stress. I didn't pay close attention to this because I don't think it's too important.
There's just a scale factor.
I mean, what it is some average. It's some appropriately average stress because what the machine does is it measures a torque. You tell it what the gap is. It does a little calculation, assuming that you have a simple velocity gradient across there, and it spits out an average stress.
The simplest thing that could happen is that you have the gel above a certain critical stress.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, you have, when you do it to control shear rate, you have positive feedback and it just goes down.
Right.
And then it could be that just the interface is wherever
the shear cell needs to
have that stress. And if you can rule that out, please do.
Yes, that is not what's happening.
Yeah, because on a log scale, 9%, which is what the difference is,
right,
the numbers you gave,
yes,
the size of the symbols, isn't it?
Right, I mean, it's really small. So that...
Yeah,
go to the proper plot.
So how big is 9%?
Yes, okay.
You know, I don't remember the numbers. I remember going through this calculation, many, many times. And it is not the case that you're just gelling it up to the stress.
The factor between sigma C and sigma S is about a factor of 2. Am I reading that correctly?
Let's see. So this is 9.8765, and this is 1. And this is like 3. So it's more than that.
It's not 3. That you've got extra ticks on the first increment. You've got on the first increment between 1 and 2, you've got 5 extra ticks.
Oh, why did it do that? That stupid thing. 9.8765. That's 0.5.
Yeah, that's right. So that's a factor of 2, so then it's about a factor of 3.
Yeah.
3. Okay, so obviously that's way outside.
Yeah, that's right. solution. Right. No, that was something we looked at very early on because you wanted to know if that was the explanation, and it's not. Yeah.
I did not remember your data. This is for a system which is above, which is shear thinning first.
Yeah. Here, let's go to the next. Let's go to the.
Is the discontinuity disappearing when you are when you have a Newtonian fluid?
Nope.
You always get discontinuity.
You can well. Yes. Yes. I mean, I can talk to you more about that. I don't have all these all the data here, but it depends upon the temperature. It depends on all sorts of things, whether you get a discontinuous jump. We can get systems that have a discontinuous jump or a continuous jump in the same system merely by changing the temperature. All right, change the temperature from, say, a low temperature, say 10 degrees, where you get a jump, to a high temperature, say 30, 32, where you don't get a jump. All right, and I didn't bring all that data along, but you can get both types of behavior. Here I've plotted it up in the way that Mike doesn't like to illustrate some points. I'd like to think it was just to irritate Mike, but I have a better way.
There is
some information in this plot, which is why I included. The first piece of information is to answer the question, is it shear thinning in the previous one? And yes, in that case, it was shear thinning. All right. The other thing that I want to show you is that up in this third region, you notice that the apparent viscosity is virtually flat here. This is, I mean, the explanation for this is simply that you have a plug with slip layers, all right, at either the outer cylinder and or the inner cylinder, all right, and that the stuff in there is behaving more or less in a Newtonian fashion, which you might expect, say, if it were largely depleted of surfactant, all right. You can actually then make some estimates as to, based on this viscosity, how thick that slip layer is. And you come up with numbers, depending upon what you assume for the viscosity of that slip layer, of something on the order of 20 to 40 microns. And I will say, Ron Larson has recently made some measurements. He was really intrigued by this slip layer, so he started making more careful measurements than we've made on the velocity profile in that near the walls. All right, he did this by seeding the flow, and he finds that something on the order of 40 microns is about what the slip layer is. All right, typically. The other thing then I want to show you is there is a fourth region here where the system starts shear thinning again. All right, and that's fairly generic. All right, and in spite of it being a bad plot, it does help you sort of identify what I think are really four distinct regions of behavior. All right. So, actually, I forget what I have next. That fourth region where it started to shear thin, it's actually getting flat out here. And hopefully, let's see what the next plot is. Oh, okay. We'll do this first, and then we'll come back to that. One thing we did is we did experiments where we went high up on this curve and then did a quench down to lower shear rates, down to A, which is above the critical shear rate, down to B, down to C, and down to D. All right. And what you get is, if you just measure the stress as a function of time, when you lower the shear rate suddenly, the stress falls in a fashion that's completely consistent with just the reduction in shear rate. That's more or less instantaneous. All right, and then at A, you just stay at that same stress. When you go down to B, which is slightly below the critical shear rate, you get some interesting behavior. That is, the system is sort of metastable in here, all right, but then eventually falls back down. You quench deeper to C, you get a sort of slower, more continuous retraction, or lowering of the shear stress. And then D, I assume that what's happening here is this is just the time scale that it takes the gel phase to evaporate, all right, and go back into the liquid-like phase.
I'm having a little problem. You've greatly exaggerated the nose on this curve.
Yes, just so you can see it. Just so you can see it. Yes, that's true.
So in fact, your A's, B's, and C's are very close together.
Yes, they are.
Okay.
Here's I picked out one of those curves like this, and then we looked at what the gel does as a function of time, and a couple things happen. I mean, it seems to be a complicated process because in here it looks like the gel is more or less all the way across the sample, and yet the stress is going down. All right. At some point, right here, around after 400 seconds, you do actually see what appears to be a gel detaching and then retracting across here. I don't tell you this to present any fancy picture of what's going on. I tell it to you only to report what happens, and to that's it. You know, that's what happens. I don't claim to understand it. All right, but it's reproducible. Okay, now I want to just look quickly. This is a slightly different concentration because it allows us to see this fourth regime more clearly. All right, so I have it plotted up in the two ways on the same plot. You get in the third regime, you get where I think is slip, and then in the fourth regime, you get something where you're pretty much at a constant stress. It eventually sort of goes up again here, all right? But the thing I want to point out, people have been talking about shear thickening and shear thinning and curves that go like this and curves that go like that. In the system, you can get both, it appears that you can get both types of behavior, all right? At the low shear rates, you have this reentrant part, you have the slip, and then you have this other type of behavior that people have seen in different systems. All right. If you arrange the concentration just right, you can get these almost to begin overlapping, and the behavior can get really confusing. All right. But it's useful to know that these two types of behavior can occur in the same thing. The circles are the controlled stress. Triangles are the controlled shear rate. It's interesting. Look, if you sit at a controlled shear rate, at a shear rate, of course, that's where you are, all right, and the system measures some stress. But if you try and control the stress here, all right, well, it has a whole bunch of possibilities for what shear rate it can lie at. And if you look, you see I have a whole bunch clumped here, and I have others clumped out here, all right? So you might wonder what the time dependence of the behavior is there, and what the time dependence is when you get right on that critical stress of 0.7 pascals, you get this behavior that looks like this with extremely long time periods, all right, of, 10, 20 minutes. And this is sort of reminiscent of some of the data that others have shown when you have similar types of rheological curves. So you get the same sort of thing in these systems as well.
Coming back to those questions, if you have those images over there in machine 4,
yeah,
you still think there's no secondary flow?
Oh, no, not at all. Look at them. You have eyes.
So all right. Like there's a lot of swirling going on.
Yeah, there's a lot of swirling going on. All right.
But the images that were troubling him also had that kind of little bit of...
A little bit, but there is structure when you're in this region, all right? I don't want to pretend there isn't structure. There is, all right? And how much structure there is depends upon the system you're working with, too. With this system, there's relatively little structure here. This is a system, this is this Ethiquette, this commercial surfactant that is almost like CTAB, but not quite. All right, CTAB is actually, as I'll show you in a second, it seems to be a little bit more fragile. All right, and there in this regime, you get more structure, and I can talk about that in a minute if you want. But the point here is that when you get into this regime where you have this, where the system almost looks like it fractures in some sense, you see very complicated time-dependent flows. All right, when this happens, you see what looks like some sort of crack through the system, and then you see it swirling up, and you see very, very complex secondary flows. All right, and
When you're in, before you get to that region, though, you said basically the gel itself is in kind of blood.
More or less, yes.
Does that mean that then it's obviously got this mottled appearance, but does that pretty much static?
It's not completely static, all right, and it depends a little bit on the system that you have. And, maybe if I could dig out the videos someday, it would be useful to see. But if you, for example, if you have the C-tab, all right, and if you look actually, you can see this in some of our first papers that we did on C-tab. If you're in this region, what you see is gel growing out from the inner cylinder. It almost looks like fingers, though. All right.
Once it's reached something approximating a steady state, which it does do that.
You still see those fingers.
So they're moving in and out.
Well, they can move in and out, but actually what more appears to be happening is, imagine you have two fingers like this, all right, or a finger sticking out like that. What makes this finger here is you'll see suddenly, say there won't be any fingers, all right, and you'll see suddenly something moving in, tending to split the gel in half and making a little plume. All right, the picture I have is that somehow you locally generate some gel that has a little bit more elasticity. All right, it forms a ring and it collapses like this and cuts the gel in half. All right, and you see little events like that going on. It's very, very complicated. All right, you see that more in something like C-tab as opposed to this system. You see it a little bit in this system, but you see it more in C-tab.
Dave?
Yeah.
Are these images shattered or not?
Shattered?
Stroboscopically?
No, there's no strobe.
I'm imagining this thing either in time or in space, because imagine I take the picture each time you're quick or whatever.
No, we're
one rotation. Will I still always see the same thing?
Or? No, it's a movie. All right. First of all, when it goes around, will you see the same thing? No. There's no periodicity associated with the periodicity of the cylinder.
So in one cylinder.
It's not like you're seeing a static thing moving around like this, and then every time it comes around, you see the same thing again. It's very dynamic. All right.
But distinctive, there must be either a frequency which is larger or smaller than that, right?
They're smaller. Faster than that. They're fast. Those fingers, it's fast. It's much faster than that rotation rate.
So that finger retraction is at that point.
It's not retraction. It's sort of cutting in half.
It's larger than 10 times a second.
No. That's the shear rate. That's not the rotation rate.
Okay.
Right? Rotation rate is much slower. All right.
What's the typical size of a finger?
I'd say no. the gaps are a millimeter, and they're maybe 1/5 of a gap, 1/6 of a gap, something like that. All right. Okay, here's something that we did recently. This is just, here's some random data that is somewhat interesting. Since these things have charges flying all over the place, we thought it might be interesting to see what the effect of changing the valency of the counter ion is. Now, maybe you're changing more than just that when you change that, but all we did was exchange the sodium for magnesium. And one thing that's interesting that Peter should like, all right, is that whereas for the sodium, you get a critical shear rate that increases with concentration, which I've always found bizarre, that is, you have an effect, all right, it happens at a certain shear rate, so you put more of the stuff in that makes it happen, which makes you think it should happen at a lower shear rate, happens sooner, all right, and it doesn't. It happens later, all right. Seems a little bit bizarre, all right, but that's the way it is, all right. So, and you get a rather rapid increase in the critical shear rate as you increase the concentration of C-tab. Interestingly, when you do it with magnesium, the system's completely the same. You just exchange the sodium for the magnesium. It goes the other way. All right. If you want to do it in terms of critical stress, all right, then for the sodium salicylate, the critical stress takes off extremely quickly, all right, whereas for the magnesium, it is more or less constant, although you have to be a little careful. This is actually varying maybe over a factor of 3 or so, but it's fairly noisy data down at those low stresses, all right.
In the CTAN,
No, that's fine.
In the sodium salicylate one, if you increase the concentration enough, then you go into some place where you no longer have gel anymore, you just have the normal bog standard.
Well, you go into this region.
So what you have these two regions. Do they collide as you increase concentration, or do they get further apart?
What, this region and this region?
As you increase
the concentration.
It shear thins and then it doesn't go all the way down to like water. It shear thins to a point and then goes back up.
And then eventually one of them disappears, right? The thickening one disappears and they collide.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You're left with a thinning one. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's right.
You don't have any kinetic data on these cases.
On which case?
Well, either or practically both. I mean, things like T-jump and so on.
No, we haven't done T-jump data yet.
But that, I think maybe with CTAP salicylate, sodium salicylate, maybe somebody has.
Not that I've seen.
Okay.
It'd be a nice thing to do.
Worth contacting Kondo or something.
Yes. Like yeah. Because they're all set up to do it.
I don't think it's happening, but I mean, one possible thing is that changing the counter ion.
It's changing the end cap energy.
Well, yeah, it's just screwing up the kinetics in a right royal fashion.
Uh-huh.
And that could change everything.
Yeah.
Without really changing the structure, we can have too much. Or it could be structural.
I know with a plot that Dave didn't get because my data file is crappy. If you plot like growth shear rate versus temperature, the end cap energies are all about the same. So magnesium and sodium.
That's not my question.
This is the last slide I want to show you, and we can have a free-for-all if you want after this. But this is just comparing some of the sodium and some of the magnesium. By the way, this is sort of put in for people like Jean-Francois. You can see down here that the viscosity is completely Newtonian, all right, at these low. This is at 1 millimolar, a fairly low concentration.
1 millipascal second, not 1 pascal second.
That's 1 millipascal second. Sorry, that's right. So this is essentially the viscosity of water. Water is 1 millipascal second. This is essentially the viscosity of water. All right. These are what the curves look like. Now, one thing I want to show you is that here we've gone to 5 millimolar. Yes.
1 millimolar of what? What's 1 millimolar?
Of surfactant.
And equimolar salt.
Equimolar salt. All these are equimolar salts. We have data on non-equimolar salts, but it's hard enough as it is. One thing that I want to point out here, there's a number of things you can do. One thing Jennifer did here was, you know, do transient experiments where, you know, this is your steady state data, but you can also jump to a shear rate or a stress corresponding to this and see what the initial viscosity is, and as you might expect, it just follows a sort of equilibrium curve the equilibrium curve before it has time then to eventually jump up to there. But another thing I want to show you is this. Notice here at 1 millimolar, it's flat with a viscosity that of water. At 5 millimolar, it's shear thinning here below the transition. And here, Jennifer's gone down to something like a shear rate of 1 inverse second, all right? Well, we all know that it has to become Newtonian at some point if you lower the shear rate enough. So one thing Jennifer's done is she's made a Zim viscometer, which is sort of the world's most sensitive low stress rheometer, all right? And she has taken the shear rates in these systems down to as low as 0.01, 1/100th of an inverse second, without any sign of this rolling over. All right. In other words, it appears that what we have is something that is truly the world's weakest gel. All right. In that you never ever reach a plateau in this vicinity of concentrations.
The power minus one.
What's the power there? No, it's not minus one. Yeah, it's slower than one. I don't know what it is here. But it's sort of interesting that these systems.
Sodium or magnesium? Or both of
them? That one's the sodium, I think, isn't it?
Why do you think the weakest gel?
How many things can you shear? I mean, at 0.01 inverse seconds, and how many gels can you shear at 0.01 inverse seconds and have it flow forever? All right, so you're breaking up the gel
So what you say that you don't find really
a plateau,
a finite. No.
Modulus?
No. But
or
it's not an elastic gel. It still flows, but it's becoming more and more viscous as you decrease the
So this means clearly this is a network of micelles that you start with, in this case, at 5 millimoles.
It seems. So it seems.
With a very long relaxation time.
With a relaxation time that is longer than 100 seconds. All right, and that's incredible when you think about it. I mean, you're dealing with little micelles that are 40 angstroms. Well, maybe one. Well, that's science is wonderful when it's incredible. Yes. After this.
Can you remind me of the literature? I can't remember. Dale Pearson was once upon a time working on flocculated suspensions that formed a percolating network, and whatever shear rate you put them on, they refined to some characteristic length scale. There was between infinity and one particle. What did they do? I can't remember what they did. I remember the story, but I can't remember.
Something like this. I mean, this is a parallel fluid that you're describing. I think the thing which is surprising about it is not so much that it's a parallel fluid, because there are other parallel fluids, and I don't know how low in shear rate people have taken them, but probably fairly low, not this low perhaps. But this is all at such incredibly low stress.
Yeah.
And so it really is really, really weak in terms of the kind of quotes effective modulus or whatever it's got.
Mm-hmm.
So that for me is more remarkable than the fact that this is continuing to get, and also the fact it's happening in the system rather than in something which you know to be a weak gel. So a parallel fluid where the viscosity is in power between 0 and minus 1 of the shear rate to as low as you can measure it is not that unusual. But the stresses are much higher than that.
Mm-hmm.
Although somehow I imagine flocculated suspensions would be down in the same ballpark.
They'd have to be awfully dilute, I think.
They could be. But there you're dealing with objects that have a size that's, you know, 1,000 times bigger than the sort of intrinsic size of the micelles. That is, these micelles have diameters of, 40, 50 angstroms.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
So why do you think that's, well,
you don't have this on stress.
We do. I didn't put it in. Sorry.
You're just teasing me. No, not including.
Can I ask Mike to elaborate a little bit on the comment that was made earlier? You said that this is exactly what theory predicts.
this theory predicted this about 15 years ago, and there was no system for which it worked, and so we quietly suppressed that theory and forgot about it. But the theory says that if you have a system where there's a very high NCAP energy for the micelle, then before you get entangled, before you reach C star, you have to make arbitrarily large loops. So you get this critical network of huge loops around the entanglement threshold. And there's been kind of the odd bit of evidence for a little bit of that, but nothing serious. And what it says then is that in the quiescent state around C star, you should see very, very long relaxation times connected with this enormous critical structure. But what is odd is you see it at 5, and there's nothing like that at 1. So I mean, it's not exactly a cure-all theory.
It is the trend.
There has always been this prediction lying around of a kind of gigantic leap state around where you would normally expect the overlap threshold to be. And but it's interesting that you get the shear thickening in both cases, you see. So you don't need that, pulling those pictures there, you don't need that to get the shear thickening.
Right. Right, you get sure.
What you do need, I mean, what I still think you do need is something in the system with a relaxation time, which is of order the inverse of the critical shear rate. So, what for a long time was mysterious is that everyone thought these micelles were a few hundred angstroms long, and the critical shear rate is 10 to 100, and in this case, 1 reciprocal second. You must have something in the system whose relaxation time can be woken up at that sort of shear rate. And one candidate is these huge network of rings or whatever. But then you see in the left-hand picture, it's an even lower shear rate. There must be something there with a relaxation time of order a second. And no sign of it in the...
Look at down here. We're down to 0.04. 0.03 inverse seconds, and
remember that's behaving, but that's new changing.
It is. I mean, there are possible. The thing is that if you have this structure, then how it behaves depends on the kinetics of these rings and how they unloop from each other and so on. And so it may be that you can kind of think of a way in which both of those curves are consistent with that picture.
Why are there rings? I mean,
because they don't want to have ends.
So no, from the data, you can always say that there are giant micelles, which are very, very large, close to infinity, but nothing tells you that there are rings.
Yes, from that data, of course you can say that. If you look at the light scattering, you realize that's a bit implausible.
Okay. So who has done the light scattering?
Well, on this system, I don't know.
We have done a little bit of light scattering. And we see a very... a strange result, which is not in agreement with the neutron scattering. The neutrons in the system we have investigated, the neutron scattering are positive and says that the micelles are short. The light scattering, dynamical light scattering, evidence a very long time, a very long relaxation time. And it's for instance, if you change the temperature, this relaxation time vanishes. And this is probably an indication of the presence of some large aggregate. I would not call them rings, I don't know.
No,
but there is something which initiates the transition. And my point is that even if the viscosity is the one of water, it does not mean that these particles or these big aggregates not pre-exist in the solution.
Is it possible to have three-fold junctions?
But threefold junctions.
You have threefold junctions, but then you'll have them all the way up in concentration. We know that at high concentration, that leads to dramatically less viscoelasticity than most of these systems show, but it can't root out.
How about the recovery time? So if you shear it at, say, 8 reciprocal seconds, and then you go down to a lower rate, how long does it take to build the system?
Wait, I'm not sure. Oh, you mean so as long as you're on this curve? I don't know. Have you investigated? I don't think you have.
Like if you just change it and see how long it takes to change.
Yeah. So if you hypothesize you have very large rings and then you break them up to smaller rings,
exactly.
There's still no free ends. So there's not a lot of driving force in terms of free energy to go back to large rings. Right. So you'd expect the recovery time.
It depends on the kinetics. I agree. Your system, right, and also Condo have recovery times of 24 hours in some cases,
yeah,
which you want to look for.
In the gel state.
So
I don't know about this state. In the gel state, I know
we've had
recovery.
This is an important point. I mean, the stress itself, like you drew a decay curve.
Right.
The stress itself can relax in a few minutes. But that doesn't mean that then if you take that sample, it hasn't remembered what you did to it.
Oh, no. That's
the recovery time.
No, that's absolutely true. I mean,
these two times are completely separate.
That's absolutely true because if you get into the gel state, I know, and then you just look at the light scattering as a measure of the recovery time, you can easily have recovery times that are 8, 12 hours on that order. Or you can have incredibly long recovery times in those cases.
Well, what about cycling back and forth without going into the gel state?
I don't know. It's a good question.
But there's sufficiently accurate predictions for the mass expert into the distribution to allow a prediction for that viscosity expert and something over unbroken constant?
No, because you don't know whether you don't know how looped up they are. So that viscosity is controlled by kinetics. So that it's not an easy thing.
Do you imagine kinetics where you have micelles bumping into each other and exchanging? That is, could you have two loops come like this and unbind, essentially go through each other and unbind?
The details, especially this thing with the long recovery time, depend on which kind of kinetics are dominant.
Right.
Stress relaxation.
Right. So in principle, you could have both, right? You can have...
Yeah, sure. And if you don't think of any other kind of clusters but just rings and stuff, then you can get a very long recovery time if the kinetics which controls the stress relaxation is not the same one that controls the population of the rings. And that's possible if you choose the right kind of kinetics, so that you can have kinetics where the stress relaxation is governed, for example, by that one.
Mm-hmm.
Or this, which is the same thing.
Right.
That's called bond interchange. And if you rip the rings up and make some change, then the relaxation of that is governed by this other one, which is end-to-end scission. And if that process is slow, and the first one is faster, then you can completely separate the two,
mm-hmm.
what we call the stress relaxation time from this recovery time.
Mm-hmm.
Because the population of what's in there is controlled by this other kind mm-hmm. of kinetics from what's letting the stress relax. So that's why I like that picture as a way of explaining those extra long time scales. But you don't always get them, I don't think. But you say you do. In this case, you have these long recovery times, like the...
Certainly from the gelled state, we can have incredibly long relaxation times. Yeah, they're faster in that system.
Well, you see, there's another thing lying around here which occurs to me, which is connects with all your stuff on the salicylate and the batch-to-batch variation to ridiculous and so on. And you say isopropyl alcohol, I agree, and then you also small amounts of added stuff. You said colloid can change the...
Yeah, I think...
That's ridiculous, except colloid is treated with a surfactant on the surface and you get a little tiny bit of that in your system. So I think that some one thing which makes these systems so sensitive to that stuff is that these impurities can catalyze mm-hmm. these reactions.
Right. No, I think that's...
So that they can change these reaction rates maybe by a factor of 10 or something with a, 10 to the minus 5.
It's probably...
And if it's a catalyst and not a structural component,
right.
changing the NCAP energy, okay, it's just not enough of it to do
right.
that. Then you can start to piece these things together, I think.
It is worth pointing out, though, that 1 millimolar is an incredibly small amount of stuff.
Yes.
I mean,
any way
you want to look at it. It's like, 100 parts per billion, a million, something like
that. If you are effectively approaching some kind of, it's even the tri-critical point, which is really this point where the micelles becomes very, very long. You should have some kind of scaling rules,
yes.
which can be called.
Right.
They're all written down.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know that they can be written down, but I want to know whether they can be merged.
There should be the usual stuff in light scattering. It's just a second order critical one.
No.
But then, of course, no one's ever seen anything that weird in light scattering. But if, on the other hand, you have only a millimolar of scattering stuff.
No, but you see, you have to go to Q equals zero. You have to go to a very small Q to see this huge structure. So regular light scattering give you a cutoff on the time because of this finite Q.
All right, come back in a month.
David?
Yeah.
I ask you, push you to describe the Drezhnev diesel around the quad. So you say you have this thing at, say, a 10 inverse shear rate. And you have 1 millimeter, so that takes what, 6 seconds to go around, something like that?
No, it's slower than that, isn't it?
Well, if it's 1 centimeter radius.
60 seconds.
2 pi times 10.
Yeah.
Okay, 60. So
that's more like it.
Okay. So the variations you see the problem is that you are zooming through the gap and going around. So there are at the same time
spatial variations. I haven't done it for a long time, all right? But 4 or 5 years ago when Philippe Boltenhagen was here, we looked to see if there was anything going on at the rotation period of the cylinders, and we could never find anything. We could never find any periodic behavior with
this. This is that you show that they extend only a little bit in the correct.
It's more that you have to appreciate. Actually, maybe this is one case where I should have videos. I should get off these videos and put them up. But this is fairly dynamical. I mean, those pictures you see are fairly dynamical. And so I think the system, you know, is changing. The macroscopic dynamics of the system change fairly rapidly. Probably owing to the high elasticity of the system and to fluctuations in the elasticity.
But how do you imagine it around? With spatial coherence or not?
Pretending that the slopes are almost inverse powers, have you made any attempt to measure how many lengths of those micelles of those the M sub C in essence, the thickness of the network?
Well, I'm not following your question.
In the apparent viscosity plot on the right of this view, you have slopes that go down like yield stress.
Yeah, and I showed you in
different magnitudes, the one at the low shear rates and the other in higher shear rates.
All right, I mean that's what this plot was about, right?
Yeah, which are the two extremes over there?
Well, here at the high stresses and high shear rates, this is essentially a -1. Power law. That's what the line is drawn in there for, because you can see this is constant stress, and you can see this rise is just slightly faster than constant stress.
Given that the initial molecule is tubular, can you apply a primitive rubber elasticity theory to see how frequently, if that was...
Oh, you want to see what the cross-link density is?
If there was a network, how big the mesh would be in the first case?
You have to know the strain.
No, you want to get it from G prime and G double prime. From G prime, you ought to be able to get a mesh length.
Well, that'd be great. What you'd have to do is do that on top of the
yes,
or,
yes.
Or before it's decayed.
Exactly, exactly.
So
and that's
good thing to try.
And that's something that with a new rheometer we have, we can in principle do. It's been occupied with another experiment. You worry a lot about that. You worry a lot about that.
You can't get better with microbiology.
Yeah.
But if you put a few beads in there and do it that way, because then you probably have time to do that after the thing is decayed.
After it's decayed.
But if you shoot the gel, you've got about 20 minutes, right?
Right.
It's not being there.
Right.
Even if the stress even kind of relaxes back, you could do microbiology perhaps in that time and get some idea of what sort of...
Right. We actually tried it. I actually are dredging up all sorts of old memories. We actually tried that with macro rheology at some point. I could probably even dig up the data. It's probably even published. I rather think it is.
You have published and forgotten.
Mike, I'm older than you are.
So this is just constant shear and then you tickle.
Yeah, no. We didn't have the capability at that time to do that. Then what we did was we turned off the shear and then wiggled it and watched that decay with time. But I was always, I mean, part of the reason I don't remember it is I had a hard time taking the data overly seriously because of these slip layers and so forth, and not really knowing what, feeling like I knew what we were measuring. So I always felt a bit uncomfortable with those, with trying to interpret those measurements.
In the case that when the you have the higher, they go back to the gel phase formation, disengagement is spinodal. When you have whatever it is happening homogeneously during the gap, are there any ways which you can probe around the data to choose between these two cases where something weak is happening everywhere and then slowly rising, or strong little bits of preformed gel are happening all over the place and percolating? It seems to me that even the mechanical response would be very, you'd expect would be different in those cases. Maybe you stop flow. So in the first case, okay, you've done it for a little bit, you've seen your weak gel there, and then you stop shearing. Mm-hmm. What you've got is a homogeneous weak gel which you can probe in this way. But if you just got little pieces of nucleated stuff with oceans of fluid between them, then you have a colloidal fluid. You should be able to tell the difference between those two.
Yeah, you might be able to tell the difference that way. I mean, no, we haven't done anything like that. I mean, one way you could imagine probing that might be through light scattering, particularly if you put little particles in there off of which you could scatter. That might be, in effect, doing microrheology, but doing it via light scattering, which would be far easier than doing it with a microscope in this case. Just because of the remote, needing to do the remote sensing, essentially. Yeah?
Another question related to this. So you have, look at the stress that came about. Sigma S is where you crossed over from heterogeneous to homogeneous nucleation?
Roughly speaking.
Okay, so if you were to continue that across and intersect with a continuation of the low shear branch, it'll intersect at some shear rate.
Yes.
So I'm asking if you control the shear rate, is there any qualitative crossover in the kinetics of the behavior when you cross that region, or is it just all smooth?
I don't know. That's a good. Yeah, I know what you mean.
You might expect you could access that point in two different ways.
And see, I didn't bring the.
It's like looking at the time scale.
We have a plot corresponding to the right one there. That's in terms of stress. I just didn't include it.
You stop seeing it. Like, well, under controlled stress, the rheometer. At the point where I stop, basically, you stop seeing the overshift. Basically, the sample goes to the steady state viscosity. The rheometer is able to keep up. And so, like, beyond the point where I've got it, there's the different. There's no distinguishing point between the steady state value and
the instantaneous.
And instantaneous.
It's for controlled strain, right?
Controlled stress.
So to clarify, you do a stress jump, and beyond that last open symbol, you immediately jump onto the curve with the blue symbol. So the first data point that you can acquire is already there.
Yeah.
May I come back to the beginning where you showed these pictures and we asked about the bioreferences? Can you tell whether part of this pride and dashboard is more oriented or more
bioreferential? Yeah, I mean, this experiment isn't well set up to do that, but using another apparatus in Gary Leo's lab, we looked at that. And the gel phase is certainly considerably more birefringent than the other. Both exhibit some birefringence, but the gel phase is considerably more birefringent than the other.
Issue that I first asked about, which is whether it's the stress or the strain rate. I mean, if it's the strain rate and you reduce this viscous state, then it's no longer being strained and it's out of equilibrium and it's got to go back to something like its original state because you feel the dynamics problems. So I think this is really the argument in favor of the stress. It's
yes.
And if this thing is sustained, once you've produced this highly viscous phase, it's no longer being sheared and it remains in that state. It seems to me it's got to be the stress.
No, I agree entirely. I agree entirely. The only fly in that ointment. All right.
It just says.
I mean, just so everyone understands, when you apply a constant stress, all right, and you say, okay, I maintain a gel phase, all right, if it's really sort of a homogeneous gel, I shouldn't say homogeneous, but a gel phase without any serious dynamics, all right, then stress can sustain a gel phase in principle, all right, you can imagine, because it's always feeling that stress. But if it's shear rate that's maintaining the gel phase, you've got a problem, because the shear rate dies inside the gel phase, and so you would imagine that it has to melt enough for it to be sheared again so that it can reform, and you'd get some sort of oscillatory behavior, all right. So I agree. The only fly in the ointment is some of the dynamics that we see, you know, with these fingers, that if you look inside these gel phases, that they're fairly dynamical objects.
I was going to come to that. If you do see meta fluctuations going on, then it could be that it's the strain rate that's causing it.
It's constantly melting internally.
And
it also relates to the thickness of the gel layer going up and down and up and down indefinitely, right?
But that was under controlled stress.
Exactly, but if it was controlled stress and it was simple, that boundary would develop and it would sit there like a rock. And it doesn't.
Well, okay, the only... I really hesitate to mention all these things. This is a 1 millimeter gap.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So if there is 10 microns of wobble in that, if your cylinder isn't perfectly round to within 10 microns, ours are. All right. Because we buy NMR tubes, and for some reason that's a great technology. They need things that are really, really round. All right. But then if it's not centered to better than 10 microns, you've got a 1% wobble in the shear rate, all right? And we clearly have that kind of thing. You know, I don't know about your machinists, but my machinists have a hard time.
But the oscillations you were showing were more than 1%. And maybe you can flip back.
No.
It's whether the period of...
It has to do with the period of the couette and how that couples, and you have all these nonlinear couplings in there.
Yeah, I've also sworn on the stack of Bibles that there was no discernible connection.
That's true.
Time for a single rotation or n rotations at a period.
You said clearly that the extra noise, call it whatever you want, was a property of this material, not of the
right.
Geometer, and we all believed you.
You said it correlated with thickness.
It does.
It does. It's hard for you to see.
That's not true.
Maybe you're right. A bit of extraneous stuff coming in, but at least the presence of the gel is somehow amplifying that.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more sensitive to it than any normal material would
be. Yes.
And that's the kind of most defensive way of putting it. You don't want to say more.
I don't. I mean, because I'm a little bit fearful of saying more.
We experimentalists will band together. Our data's not really crap. We just don't know what's going on. No, actually, this is a lovely
thought,
actually.
No. The good thing about being an experimentalist is you know at least some of your scientific information is not crap. That is something that a theorist can almost never say.
Just before you all have your class, I say three things. One is, last week something didn't happen that's nice to happen. Largely the answer to Fred McIntosh is that once a week on Wednesdays, we like to nucleate a cooperative restaurant with it. I'm not really able to do this because I have dinner with children. But if anyone would like to nucleate a restaurant visit on Wednesday night, then please, when they come here, just get up at some point and say, who wants to come with me and to help us send to El Nino Bar and Grill, or who it is, or another night, that would be nice. Also, I gather there have been some hard work over the weekend, bombarded Peter, right, after his seminar. At some point this week, we'll try and squeeze in a what's the curvy shape of the service now.
Yeah.
That report from Peter. And this afternoon is Paul Callahan at 2 o'clock. Don't miss it. Be here. Come back. Or just stay with me all through lunch.
There you go.
Okay. Yeah.